Today is Monday, September 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington.
It is so important to be here tonight to honor her fight.
Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died Friday night. As the nation remembers her life, we take a look at her legacy.
She was somebody who was very much a people person, and she had the admiration and affection of people on the right and the left because she was so kind.
And protests continue in Thailand. We'll have these stories and more next. Longtime Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, only the second woman to serve on the court, died Friday from complications of cancer. Ginsburg, a stalwart liberal and champion of women's rights, died at her home in Washington, surrounded by her family, according to a statement from the court. Ginsburg was 87. That night, outside the Supreme Court, many came to honor the justice, including Tara Plotsky, a constitutional lawyer.
I mean, RBG has been one of our heroes since law school, where we met in 2004. You know, the 14th Amendment literally didn't apply to women's rights until RBG made courts start to apply it to women's rights. It's absolutely incredible, and she paved the way for all of us and just felt like the right thing to do to come down and pay our respects immediately.
Alongside Plotsky was Noma Nwagu, an international development lawyer from Nigeria.
Just in terms of our untiring fight for equality for women that continues till this day, it is so important to be here tonight to honor her fight and to make a commitment to continuing that fight.
For a broader perspective on Justice Ginsburg's life, I spoke with Joel Paul at the University of California Hastings College of the Law.
She was extremely considerate to people. She had a very close friendship with Antonin Scalia, who was the most outspoken conservative member of the court, with whom she often tangled in decisions. But on her desk in her office in the Supreme Court, she had a photograph of the two of them together performing in an opera. They both loved opera, and they once had a small role in a Washington, D.C. opera. She was somebody who was very much a people person, and she had the admiration and affection of people on the right and the left because she was so kind.
If we take a look at Justice Ginsburg's career, she was only the second person to be appointed to the Supreme Court. What's been her impact and really her legacy?
Justice Ginsburg was a critical figure in the development of the law of gender equality. She, as a young attorney, started taking on a number of cases that went up to the Supreme Court that really challenged assumptions that the law made about the roles that were appropriate for men and women. And really the seminal cases, the foundational cases that really kind of established the principle of gender equality were all cases that she actually argued before the Supreme Court. So when you think about her legacy, it's important to think about it not just in terms of the enormous contributions she made as a member of the Supreme Court, but also in terms of the enormous contributions she made, probably even greater contributions she made as an attorney, which really reshaped American law.
What about her time on the court itself?
Well, the first woman appointed to the court was Sandra Day O'Connor by President Reagan. That was his first court appointment. She was not appointed until President Clinton. So, I mean, for a long period of time, we only had one member of the court. Justice Ginsburg liked to say that gender equality would not be fully achieved until there were 9 women on the Supreme Court. And since she's joined the court, 2 other women have joined the court. And I think that the significance of her role on the court was that she was a more centrist or more liberal member of the court than Justice O'Connor. And I think she kind of brought Justice O'Connor along and some other members of the court along on a number of important cases, not just cases involving gender equality. She tended to be someone who worked towards the middle. She was a consensus builder. She's was admired by people on both the right and the left of the court, and more nationally by judges, as a kind of judge's judge. I mean, she's a very solid technician. She was very cautious in the way that she wrote opinions. Her opinions don't have the kinds of pyrotechnics that Justice Scalia's opinions have, where he's always often sarcastic in his opinions. He was sometimes chastising his colleagues on the court. Her opinions are always more technical. There's less great quotes from her opinions. But from a lawyer's point of view, from just in terms of the technique, she's a much better lawyer and a much better judge. And people admired her for that.
Joel Paul is a professor at the UC Hastings Law School in San Francisco, California. U.S. President Donald Trump says that he will nominate Justice Ginsburg's successor this week. Anti-government demonstrations returned to the streets of Thailand this past weekend. Reporter Philip Sherwell is in Bangkok, and I spoke to him to learn more about this past weekend's events.
There were mass protests in Bangkok this weekend, and they really reached a new peak of intensity, because the protesters are demanding democratic reforms here and changes to the government. But they are also, and this is very explosive stuff in Thailand, they are calling for reforms to the monarchy. Now, the royal family has long been a very venerated institution here, and criticisms or suggestions of reform have been considered taboo, and it would be sacrosanct to suggest otherwise. So the demonstrators occupied a place called Royal Fields. Now, that is right in the heart of old Bangkok. It is next to the Grand Palace, the gleaming spires of the palace. And it's traditionally the location for royal ceremonies, and most recently the cremation of the late king in 2017. The protesters streamed onto there on Saturday afternoon, camped out overnight, remained there on Sunday morning, gave a series of quite fiery and bold speeches calling for royal reforms. And then on Sunday morning, a highly symbolic act, they dug a plaque into the turf there and planted it and installed it. And it was a plaque highlighting the importance of democracy in Thailand. It stated, this country belongs to the people, not the monarchy. And a previous plaque in another location nearby had disappeared 3 years ago, which celebrated the end of the absolute monarchy in 1932. So this was a sort of reinstallation of a plaque that means much more than just its location on the ground.
Now, these protests have been taking place for some time, and a lot of the focus has been on their calls for reformation in Thailand regarding the constitution and the government there. But what were their demands regarding the monarchy in Thailand?
They would like, they've got a 10-point manifesto, but the essential points are that they would like to reduce the political influence of the monarchy. They would like to reduce the power of the monarchy over military appointments, and they would like a review of the royal family's financial setup. That although the royal family has its own sources, considerable sources of wealth, that they also receive money from the public funds. They would also like an end to the draconian lèse majesté laws that actually protect the royal family from criticism, and which almost certainly were being breached by these students by their very presence and very words on Saturday night and Sunday morning.
Were any of the protesters detained this weekend?
Not over the weekend. The government, which is a military-backed government and which is very, very sort of pro the royal family, had made clear they wanted to avoid confrontation if at all possible, although if the students had tried to do anything too ambitious in terms of reaching the palace, then there would have been definitely action on the streets. But what they have been doing is, over the last few weeks, arresting a series of student leaders, arresting and jailing them, but charging them with quite serious offences, with sedition, which carries a potential 7-year jail term. So I would expect there'll be charges brought against these students in coming days.
Philip Sherwell reports from Bangkok, Thailand. U.S. President Donald Trump says that he has given his blessing to a proposed deal that would see the popular video sharing app TikTok partner with Oracle and Walmart to form a U.S. company. Trump has targeted Chinese-owned TikTok for national security and data privacy concerns. The announcement comes just a day after the Commerce Department announced restrictions that, if put in place, could eventually make it nearly impossible for TikTok fans to use the app. The Commerce Department's notice would also have placed restrictions on the communications app WeChat, but in a ruling dated on Saturday, Magistrate Judge Laurel Beeler in California said the government's actions would affect users' First Amendment rights, as an effective ban on the app removes their platform for communication. Now, to unpack the security concerns, I spoke with Scott Shackelford, director of the cybersecurity program at Indiana University. I began our conversation by asking him if the proposed deal successfully address the security concerns.
I would argue that no. I mean, that fundamentally, it's kind of much to do about nothing, right? Because we're talking about the sale of a minority stake in this organization, where still, you know, 80%+ is going to be in the hands of, in this case, Chinese entities. So if the concern is that the at some point in the process, the Chinese Communist Party could exert its leverage to influence the data that's being collected and potentially utilized in ways that we might be not be comfortable with. Well, I think that's still a very much alive opportunity, you know, for them. So I think at the end of the day, this is maybe a Band-Aid, and politically it could be, you know, chalked up as something of a win for the administration, but it certainly doesn't get to the root of the problem that they profess to be concerned about.
In movies, we always see hackers breaking into systems, and we've heard about programmers placing backdoors into different applications to try and get data. So is there really any way to protect user data from ultimately getting to where you don't want it to go?
No. There's really not.
So what is the right balance, in your opinion, to strike between what a country's national interest may or may not be legally and, you know, functionality in terms of being part of a global community?
You know, it really comes down to what the core, you know, perceived national interests are of these different groups. And in the U.S., for example, but also even in China, it oftentimes boils down to this idea of protecting their critical infrastructure. So in other words, these sectors, these organizations that they view as being critical to the functioning of, you know, their economy and their society. In the U.S., we have a bit of a laundry list of these. We have 16 of these sectors, from telecommunications to finance to electricity, defense, and as of January 2017, you know, voting and our voting infrastructure as well. And the good news is pretty much every major nation in the world, so the G20, for example, has signed on to this idea that international law applies to cyberspace and that civilian critical infrastructure should be off limits. The tricky part is we haven't operationalized what we mean by civilian critical infrastructure, right? So do we mean the finance sector, for example? Do we mean healthcare? Do we mean voting? And then going along with that, what restrictions, right? What safeguards should each of these countries be allowed to put, as we're seeing now, on, for example, their financial systems, dealing with WeChat, right, to protect that from foreign influence or kind of perceived national security issues? So frankly, that's the kind of thorny discussion that's underway right now through two different parallel tracks at the UN, one that was sponsored by the U.S., one that was sponsored by Russia. And the idea is that countries are going to have to be more transparent with their own views and how they think about international law applying, for example, to these types of issues. So hopefully we're going to get some, you know, frankly, a better view on that topic right now, because it is really tough and it varies a lot country to country. And until we can get some more convergence, frankly, we're not going to get very far.
Scott Shackelford is the director of the cybersecurity program at Indiana University. And still to come.
We do several activities here. We train the students, we train the youth, most especially in the community here. We train these guys on how they can become great artists.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists sifting through mountains of data gathered by NASA's Cassini mission continue to make amazing discoveries about Saturn and its moons. One of the highlights of the mission was the discovery of geysers spewing jets of icy water high above the ring planet's moon Enceladus. Researchers used that valuable Cassini data to create some new composite images that provide what the space agency says are the most detailed global infrared views ever produced of Enceladus. After analyzing the data they used to make the remarkable images, the researchers found what they call strong evidence that the moon's northern hemisphere has been resurfaced with ice from its interior. A theory put forth after Cassini snapped images of the jets of water erupting from the surface of Enceladus is that there is a massive liquid water ocean below its icy crust. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said on Sunday that the United States faces defeat in its move to reimpose UN sanctions on Tehran. Iran has dismissed the U.S. sanctions move as void and illegal. And in a letter seen by VOA, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the Security Council Saturday that he cannot take any action on the U.S. declaration because there would appear to be uncertainty on the issue. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that in the coming days, the United States will announce a range of additional measures to strengthen the implementation of U.N. sanctions and hold violators accountable. He added that the U.S. maximum pressure campaign on Iran will continue until Tehran reaches a comprehensive agreement with the U.S. to rein in its proliferation threats and stop spreading chaos, violence, and bloodshed. The U.S. move to try and restore U.N. sanctions has been rejected as illegal by most of the rest of the world, including other Security Council nations. COVID-19 will be on the top of the agenda during the United Nations General Assembly next week in New York. And for more on the annual summit, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke with VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir.
So I think you have to realize it's going to be a very different General Assembly this year. Normally, we have at least 100 presidents and prime ministers and royalty coming to New York attending these meetings. And some people call it diplomatic speed dating because you have all these bilateral meetings among the leaders. And there's a lot of in-person, face-to-face contact. And that's what makes the UN General Assembly week so important. But this year, of course, due to the coronavirus pandemic, it's going to be essentially a virtual meeting of world leaders. And so this has presented challenges, but it's also presented opportunities. One of the opportunities is that it's easier for people to participate, and they have actually a record participation for this year. There's about 120 heads of state attending virtually and 54 heads of government. And normally you'd get maybe 70 or 80 heads of state coming and maybe 30 heads of government. So it's a much bigger, higher level representation. They will give pre-recorded statements that will be played in the General Assembly. And it's that big iconic hall with the dome. This year, it will not be full of people because of COVID-19. Only one representative will be allowed from each country, which basically is their ambassador at the United Nations. Definitely COVID will be the topic, but we're also going to hear about rebuilding sustainably, coming back from this pandemic in a better place. It's shown in inequalities throughout the world, inequalities in healthcare and in jobs and things like that. So there's going to be a lot of discussion about how the world comes back from this stronger and more sustainable. And that also includes action on climate change, because that has really been a flagship issue for the UN. And it would have probably been the top issue at this General Assembly if it hadn't been for COVID. But it really is a part of the pandemic. So it will become a part of the recovery from it.
That was VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking to VOA's Jason Patinkin. The COVID-19 pandemic has upended the lives of nearly every person and every nation on the planet, and in a myriad of ways, from the most prosaic to the most profound. Just as disparate are the areas of research and expertise that have gone into controlling the pandemic, or at least mitigating its most extreme effects on health and society. Recently, the British medical journal, The Lancet, formed a commission to foster collaboration between leaders in the health sciences, business, and public policy, as well as humanitarian work sectors. The journal sent a letter to the United Nations General Assembly that outlined four principles that promote concerted global action concerning the crisis. Now, to find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with economist Jeffrey Sachs, university professor at Columbia University and president of the United Nations Sustainable Development Network in New York. Professor Sachs also played a key role in forming the Lancet COVID-19 Commission. He began the conversation by listing just some of the specialists taking part in that massive interdisciplinary effort.
So public health specialists, the epidemiologists, medical doctors, virologists, ecologists who understand how diseases spread from nature to humans, financiers who understand how things get paid for, especially national budgets, the vaccine developers, the leaders of humanitarian relief, and so on. Each of these communities of action has a major role to play in this very difficult, complicated, very fast-moving, and very deep crisis. And yet these communities don't easily speak with each other. So the purpose of the COVID-19 Commission is to get the big picture and to help governments to understand the big picture.
The commission listed four main points in its letter to the UN General Assembly. What were they?
The first point is that this is a controllable pandemic. Some countries say, oh, it's hopeless. Well, it's just going to have to run its course. That is the wrong idea. This pandemic can be stopped, and daily life and economic activity can be reestablished. The countries that have done the best in this are the Asia-Pacific countries, China, Korea, Japan, New Zealand, Australia. In those places, the amount of death and infection is really very, very low. Then, unfortunately, you go to countries like Spain, Italy, France, the United States, and many other countries in the Americas. The amount of death or cases per million population is sometimes 100 times higher than it is in the Asia-Pacific region.
I know that guiding the humanitarian fallout from the pandemic is also a primary concern to the commission.
Well, people are going hungry, and we need an urgent awareness at the international level to help finance poor countries to buy food or emergency equipment or other kinds of social protection or medical gear and equipment in place.
Significantly, I note that promoting inclusivity and justice between all nations, rich and poor, is a vital element of the Commission's work and ethos.
We point out how important it is that any effective vaccines that come along aren't just for a few rich countries, but are for the whole world. So we're going to be really watching this process carefully and sounding the alarm if it's not handled in a fair way. We point out that the core moral charter of the UN is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It says that everybody on this planet has human dignity and has the right to food, to sustenance, to social protection, to education, to health care. These are universal rights.
And you say that this deep moral commitment must be applied to the economic sphere as well.
Of course, in responding to the pandemic to date, some countries shut the economy for weeks or months as a kind of desperate measure because they didn't have other public health measures properly in place. So if we look around the world, economic activity, output, and incomes have plummeted. Remittance flows have dropped considerably to poor countries because the people sending the remittances from work in the richer areas lost their jobs, for example, or lost their incomes. And tourist revenues have gone down sharply. So it's an unprecedented economic crisis we haven't really seen for 90 years or so. And part of the work of the commission will be to identify those needs and to point out the ways that those urgent resources can be mobilized. This is what we need to do, and we need to keep up the fight to get that done.
Columbia University economist Jeffrey Sachs is the president of the United Nations Sustainable Development Network and one of the key originators of the Lancet COVID-19 Commission. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Heather Maxwell is the host of VOA's Music Time in Africa radio program, and she takes us into the world of colors, specifically into the world of Nigerian artist Clement Colors. She interviews this prolific painter virtually in his art studio in Kaduna, where beauty, goodness, corruption, and even sexual violence are inspiring subject matter for his and his students' paintbrush.
Hello. Joining me all the way from Kaduna, Nigeria, is an amazing painter and artist. His name is Clement Colors. Hi, Clement. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm good.
At what point in your life and how did you decide you were going to be an artist and a painter?
As a kid, I didn't really know that I'm going to become an artist. But I knew I was going to be an artist after my higher institution, that's after the university, when I went fully into it. And that is when I knew that, yes, this is where I belong.
Now, I'm joining you virtually. I'm in Washington, D.C., and you're there in your art studio in Kaduna. What goes on in the studio?
We do several activities here. We train the students. We train the youth, most especially in the community here. We train these guys on how they can become great artists, how they can draw, how they can paint using several media.
And what media do you specialize in? What do you use there?
We use several media, but we concentrate on the oil on canvas. Then we have the enamel on board, that's the slim board. This enamel on board is cheaper than the canvas. And here in this environment, most of the youth can't afford the oil on canvas, and we paint on the wall. But mostly we do our practicals on the wall, that's the graffiti aspect.
And what do you say to parents of your students who probably more often than not say, you know, art is not going to bring our children and our family financial or professional success?
Due to the low art appreciation here in this community and in Kaduna State, we have reduced the level of the way we talk to parents. So if I should create a good artwork and they love it, they'll allow their kids to come, those that are interested, so that they can produce the same for them. And by the time they have it close to them, they'll love it. So this is the only way I use to talk to parents. Because when you do it practically for them and they see it and they appreciate and love it, then they will release their kids to you.
What drives you personally to constantly be painting and creating?
The major driving force is beauty. Beauty drives me crazy a lot. When I see beautiful things, I want to create them. And when I sit down and I imagine beautiful stuff, I want to have it close to me.
Out of all of your work to date, what are the top most meaningful pieces to you?
It is the painting of my self-portrait I did. The one I closed my mouth with, the 1,000 naira note. That's the currency here in Nigeria. You see, it talks about the naira and then communication and then who you are. Like, if you should collect this naira note, you may not say what you want to say. So if you do not say what you want to say, that simply means you are dying silently because you are not expressing yourself just because of that naira note. And the naira note can't satisfy your needs till eternity. Then the second painting that drives me crazy is the painting I created last year. It talks about rape in the society. On that painting, I showed people that in 2020, there will be a lot of rape cases, and it's going to take place even within family. So parents should be very careful with their children, and ladies should be careful wherever they go to.
Clement Colors, I wish we could talk all day, and I wish I could be right next to you in your studio. It's just amazing. Thank you so much for sharing your work and your creative process and the beauty that you show us around the world. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for this time.
That was VOA Music Time in Africa host Heather Maxwell, speaking to artist Clement Colors. And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, Thank you very much for listening. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.